selfish bit. Mark told me to ditch my notes, so I'm going to try to sort of ditch my notes. Okay, I want to give you two talks. Just two short ones. The first, I hope will be mildly entertaining, and then the second, I hope will be an encouragement to you as I share with you how God saved me. And I'll probably cry, so I've got my Kleenex in my sleeve, and I'm already like the old lady. Okay, a few fun memories about working at the church office. In 1987, I was trying to make an extra dollar driving the Logos school bus. I had a 60-passenger bus, full extendo version, with a dual axle and 5-speed, and it was full of kids. I can't believe I did it. I mean, it was amazing. Anyway, one morning I picked up the Wilson kids, and Nate gave me a note to go see Doug in his little cubbyhole office at Logos, which was just like this little teeny tiny place. Of course, I thought I was in trouble, and I got a terrible stomach ache, and I don't know, I made it through the bus route with all the children, got in there safely, and I went in to talk to Doug, and he offered me the job as a secretary of the church, and they'd never had a secretary before, so okay, I thought, all right, I'll give that a try. And Michael was 3 at the time, so I set up my office in our dinky little bedroom. I had 2 desks and a file cabinet. It was super crowded. I had never even turned on a computer. So, I mean, it was so scary. The monitor was like 1.5 feet deep, big old beige thing, I think. And the screen was black with green lettering, and we had DOS was the operating system. And it was really hard. So there was no such thing as the internet, of course. Mark would hang over my shoulder, and I would bravely turn the computer on, scared to death that I was going to break something. But I got the hang of that. Anyway, my first job Doug had me do was transcribing the famous Jim Wilson bitterness tape. I had a dictation machine, which is like this little box, and with a foot pedal, and am I popping? It's kind of popping. Is it? Okay. Anyway, so you put the cassette tape in the dictation machine, push the foot pedal, and I type a little bit, and then I push the foot pedal, listen a little bit more, type a little bit more. Anyway, is this popping? Do I need backup? Back up?
Just a little.
Okay. All right. So Doug surprised his dad with that and made it into the famous booklet. One of the sweetest things that I did in those early days was I got the copy, Bessie Wilson's copy of The Loveliness of Christ by Samuel Rutherford, and it had all her little notes in it with her little pretty little handwriting, and I copied that, and Doug put that into booklet form too. So that was really, I just remember that was just the sweetest thing to read all her little notes. The church had a free magazine called Credenda Agenda. A lot of you remember that. It started with 150 on the mailing list and grew to 20,000. And my job was to get that baby in the mail every month or month and a half and keep up with the circulation, which was really hard and a ton of work. I'd get a bunch of kids together and bribe them with donuts. Nate, Becca, Annie, you know, a bunch of the Miller kids probably helped me. We would collate, hand staple, and postal sort all the magazines. It was really a ton of work. Now, as it got bigger, of course, we did more automated stuff, but it wasn't very profitable, being as it was free. At that time, I did most of the bookkeeping for the church. I think I may have had 5 checkbooks in my desk. Canon Press was super small, and we kept the inventory in a storage unit. I would call the manager. He'd go pick up, you know, 4 reforming marriage, take them to his house. I'd make arrangements. I'd go over to his house, pick up the books, then I'd go and package them and mail them. So things have changed. Okay. A few years after I started, Doug moved from Logos to a little hole-in-the-wall dark office on Washington Street. It was really little and dark. But he had his own little space. And keep in mind, there still was no such thing as emailing or the internet. I'd go get the mail at the post office every morning, and probably Michael would tag around with me. And then I'd go check with Doug for my marching orders for the day. Around that time, the April Fool's joke started. This, now keep in mind, many of you remember Doug Jones. He was on staff then. That was his favorite holiday. So it got really crazy. From one of the guys tricking Doug Wilson that he was going to be on Nightline, to Doug Jones having an investigation, a CIA investigation scare, it was a free-for-all. Once, a fake bomb was delivered by UPS to one of the cannon guys, and he was a deep-sea diver, and that was very exciting. Do you remember that, Annie? Yeah, that was exciting. Then I was thinking of some other ones. I remember John Schwant filled Doug Jones's file cabinet with packing peanuts and stole his guitar and filled that with packing peanuts. Wasn't happy about that. And then there was somebody drew an outline of a dead guy on Roy Atwood's driveway, you know, like the police dead guy, put police tape and stuff. But it all ended when somebody, I'm not too sure exactly who it was, but I have my suspicions, they stole Patch Blakey's pickup and took it to Pullman and put a for sale sign on. And that wouldn't have been so bad, but Deb had her wallet in the car and all her credit cards and checkbook. So she was like frantically, you know, closing out her checking account and stuff. It was awful. So it had gone too far. But in the last few years, it started up again with Ben Merkel. He called me after church on Sunday, or left a message on my phone, and he said Phil McMurray was going to come to the office that Sunday and take my chair away and raise my desk. And then he said, "Oh, Chris, it'll be okay. Your bad back, I'll get used to it." Well, I emailed him and texted him and called him, leaving him messages. In about 30 seconds, I was in a panic. You all know me, I can't stand for very long. Anyway, Mark was really mad. He thought it was a total plot by Ben to get rid of the old people. So Ben said that my message on the phone was so desperate he wanted to put it on YouTube. He thought he was really funny. However, Maggie Church and I got back at him with Rusty Opes' help a couple times. We had posters about him being this Christian love counselor. And then this campaign about hair growth products. And Mark, you know, he's got the bald head, and then Mark put some MC guy's hair on, photoshopped his hair on, the hair on his head. And so, you know, once I didn't have hair, and now I do, by Ben Merkel. So, anyway, we thought we were really funny, and it was really funny. I haven't done anything for the last year or so I got to kind of think about it. Maggie's gone, so I can't do it. Okay, so I'm going to go back a little bit. I'm almost done with this talk. After 7 years at home, Michael went to school, so we moved our office to a new location on C Street, where State Farm is, kind of over by Moscow Medical. We had several little offices in that building. Cannon Press was in the back. Annie worked there in Cannon Press. And we had a little hall called Greyfriars Hall, and it was about 10 feet long, maybe, and there was a little sign, Greyfriars Hall, and it was right outside the bathroom that the guys and the girls shared. That was just super wonderful. And I remember the NSA kids coming there. We had a little coffee station with a big bowl of sugar cubes, and they hadn't had breakfast. And so there was one particular young man that would just have to stand there and just eat the sugar cubes, and that was his breakfast. So anyway, lots of fun memories then. I think we started emailing about this time, and then I still remember hovering over Brian Gibbs's shoulder, and he said, "You know, there's this new thing called Google." And, you know, it was like, "Oh, Google, that's really interesting." So anyway, our lives were changed after that. After being there for a few years, we moved to Anselm House, and we've got, like, the super bright and cheery office that Rachel Jankovic designed, And if you haven't been up there, you need to come up before we have to move again because Gritman bought the office. I've had about 20 girls work for me over the last 28 years. And I've grown to love each and every one of them. Miss Catherine, Trish, who else is here that's worked for me? That's it, I guess. Anyway, but I would be really excited if I could get him as a freshman in college and then get him for 4 years. That was really fun. Maggie Church has the record at 7 years. So the church has grown so much, Canon has taken off, Credenda went online, and we got really good at using Google and no longer have to use the phone chain for prayer requests. And so I love working at the office, and I hope I can continue as long as I can get up the stairs and my knees don't give out. Okay, that's that. That's that talk. I could have done a bunch more, but, you know, I had limited time. Okay, now, if I start to cry, I apologize. But this was a great blessing for me to do this. This was really an encouragement to me to give my little story. Of course, I've left out lots of details. And I would practice at home with my phone as I'd write it up. And one time I was practicing, and I just sat there and just started bawling. I mean, I'm in the house by myself in the kitchen, you know, bawling to my iPhone. So, anyway, and it just really encouraged me how God pulled me from the depths. So, here I go. I was the eldest of six kids. There were five girls and a boy. We were all baptized in the Catholic Church, and I went to Catholic school until the sixth grade. My dad was a banker who poured his life into the bank. He worked and worked and worked. I always tried to be the good little responsible Catholic girl, and as they say, and getting good grades, going to Mass every day. This is important. I was always trying to get my dad's approval, but he never gave me much encouragement at all. It was basically survival of the fittest in my family. Lots of fighting and yelling. Meals were torturous, but at that time I thought that was normal. Looking back, I've realized it was a very dysfunctional family unit. I was the popular girl in high school. I was salutatorian. I got good grades. I was a cheerleader. Can't do that anymore. I was friendliest, prep club president, on most pages of the yearbook, and that was my goal. I was always trying to, I know, it's really embarrassing to admit this. I was always trying to please people and be accepted, and looking back, I know that was really phony. I went through Rush at the U of I and was dropped by my favorite sorority, and I was totally devastated. Isn't that pitiful? So I did join another sorority, after a couple years, in my desperate need to be accepted and loved, I got caught up in the whole hippie movement. And I was a true child of the Woodstock generation. If you don't know what that is, you can look it up on the internet, but you probably shouldn't. Some of you know what that is. I got a bunch of new friends who were also very mixed up people, and it was a really bad scene. When I went home my sophomore year of college, I was really sad to leave my new far-out hippie family and couldn't wait to see them again. I made a trip down here to Moscow because I was going to see my family, and they were just indifferent to me, and my heart was broken. I was a messed-up, scarred, and hurting 19-year-old. I remember working up the courage to go to confession at the Catholic Church, and all the priest could say after I spilled it was, well, you won't do that again, will you? Say good act of contrition, which did nothing. I mean, it was like, I was so empty. At that time, one of the guys I knew was starting his search for God, and he talked to me about him. What he said wasn't theologically sound, but God used it to light a little flicker in my life. Later that summer, I was 19 still, I was Here it comes out, the dirty laundry. I was illegally on Fairchild Air Force Base at the PX with one of my girlfriends. She talked to me. I still remember this conversation. We were sitting in the bathroom or something, and she was talking to me about Jesus being her friend and having a personal relationship with him. And she seemed really happy. I've never heard this concept before. Being raised in the Catholic Church, I always believed in God but was afraid. I wanted to please, but I could never do enough. When I thought of Jesus, I pictured the statues in the church of bloody Jesus in Mary's arms. They always made me sad and afraid, and now she tells me I could have a personal relationship with this God-man. That sounded interesting. I remember really listening to her, but not interesting enough as I proceeded to practice my shoplifting skills at the PX, knowing full well that an undercover surveillance lady was watching me. I knew I saw her there. I knew she was watching me, and I did it. I don't know why I did it. I got arrested and booked in the Spokane County Jail with no sympathy from the officers, despite my pleading of innocence. Yeah, whatever. They put me in a cell with a bunch of women prisoners in shifts and rubber sandals, smoking Pall Mall Straights and playing poker. And I was really in trouble. Dad bailed me out and wouldn't talk to me for a really long time. I still remember walking in the kitchen after coming back from Spokane, and ugh, it was awful. He was so mad at me. He prided himself in being an honest guy, and what I did was one of the worst things anybody could do. I was at such a low point. My friends had forgotten me. I had lots of hippie scars. Dad wouldn't look at me. I was lonely and insecure, and I had to appear in court. At this time, I had some friends who had just become Christians. They invited me to an outdoor Bible study in the backyard of an older Christian couple's home. At that study, I asked Jesus into my heart. I think at that time, I just wanted to follow the cool Jesus people thing, because that was the day of the Jesus people movement and stuff. But God held on to me tightly in spite of all my insecurities, and I was truly saved from the depths of despair and sin. I was spiraling downhill, and God rescued me from the darkness. I really knew my sins had been forgiven. I felt happy, and I felt loved, and I knew I belonged. Looking back, I realized God protected me from so many horrible things that I truly deserved. He held me close when I didn't even know him. My life finally made sense, and I've been able to forgive Dad for not showing me the love when I needed it so much, and I'm very thankful. I always think of this old hymn. It's sort of my anthem in my head. It's "On Christ the Solid Rock I Stand. All other ground is sinking sand."